Today's episode of the Startup Slingshot is brought to you by Sunag Consulting. Sunag Consulting has been helping startups exceed their business goals through interactive initiatives, including website design, social media marketing, and mobile marketing strategies for over 5 years. You can find them online at sunagconsulting.com or by phone at 615-669-3269. Now on to the show.
My name is William Griggs, and this is the 16th episode of the Startup Slingshot, a series that delivers guidance from experienced entrepreneurs and business experts on how to dream, launch, and grow your business. Today's guest is Bobby Guy. Bobby is an attorney specializing in business reorganization. Simply put, he works with troubled businesses to return them to profitability. Today, we're going to talk with Bobby about his recent book, Distressed to Success, and he's going to share with us 10 reasons companies fail and what you can do to help your company survive and thrive. Enjoy. All right, Bobby, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
All right. Here. Yeah, thanks. So tell us a little bit about your background.
I am a lawyer. I've got a degree in economics from Whittier College and have a law degree from Vanderbilt University. I've been in Nashville for about 20 years now, and I moved here when I was 22. It was the 19th place I'd lived. So my Wow. father was in the Army. We've been all over the place.
Yeah, so tell us a little bit more about kind of your professional experience and what you're doing these days.
Yeah, I'm a lawyer basically specializing in helping companies that are struggling find their way back to profitability. And the other, I do basically two things. That's one. And the second is helping companies find and buy distressed opportunities out in the market, sort of looking for the bargain basement deals and then executing upon them. And I'm at a Frost Brown Todd, which is a full-size, you know, full-service law firm with offices across the region that does everything from venture to public offerings. I specialize sort of in the profitability piece and the restructuring part of the equation.
Gotcha. So you said that you focus mainly on a couple things, which is one, helping entrepreneurs turn around or business owners turn around their organization. Then you talk about helping buyers find those organizations to purchase or assets to purchase at rock bottom prices so they can then turn around and use your expertise that way. And you even recently wrote a book called Distress to Success. Can you tell us a little bit about that book?
Yeah, Distress to Success, basically, I realize that in a lot of cases I give the same advice. And there's a ramp up on what we do as counselors in situations where you're dealing with a distressed company, either because you're looking at acquiring it or because you're trying to figure out how to turn it around. And by the way, I should say when we talk about distressed companies that one of the biggest problems is the understanding of what distress actually is. All companies have some level of dysfunction. And the key is that most companies, if you get in and deal with the dysfunction at an early stage, then you get some performance consulting and things like that, and the company does fine and it pulls through and no problems. Other issues, if you let the issues continue to fester, you end up moving more to probably a full restructuring, and the company's, you know, you lose value the more time you're in the process. If nobody ever attacks the problem, then you end up potentially in a liquidation and the company doesn't make it. So to bring that back to the book, I've found that in the situations we end up giving a lot of the same advice a lot of the time. And the biggest issue is that that people often view companies in two categories, healthy or sort of bankrupt. And there's this whole whole spectrum in between those two of different levels of health. And so the key is to understand sort of where a company fits in there so that it gets help before it actually becomes bankrupt. And that's the piece that gets missed most of the time. So the book sort of walks through the process of recognizing distress, of understanding what the strategies are for dealing with any sort of financial distress at a company, and understanding that basically bankruptcy isn't often the best strategy. There are a lot of other strategies that work very successfully if you intervene early enough that save value for the company, and bankruptcy or Chapter 11 reorganization, for example, becomes sort of the last resort. So I do a lot of Chapter 11 work, but my my I sort of view the highest value of what we get to do as trying to save companies from ever having to file Chapter 11. So the so to talk about the book, then there are two pieces. The first half is talking about what restructuring is overall, how to recognize it, how to understand it, how to turn a company around. And then the second half is about distressed investing, how to find opportunities, buy them, what it looks like on structuring different distressed acquisition opportunities. And the to fill that out, both pieces of those sort of go together, obviously, because the acquirers need to know what the struggling companies are thinking, the struggling companies need to know what the acquirers are thinking, and all of those fit together. So that's the book overall. It came out in May of this year.
Gosh, that makes a lot of sense. So I guess kind of to recap or summarize, it seems like, or you said that you wrote this book partly as a primer for some of your clients to kind of get them to understand. You felt like you kept repeating yourself. So this is the one way that, you know, we talked about a little bit earlier, establish your credibility, but also reduces your workload a little bit. So it sounds like a smart move on that side or from that front. And then also you talked about how, you know, there's all sorts of dysfunction, and there's always dysfunction in businesses. And can you start off by kind of defining what is distress and give us some examples of how companies or what kind of dysfunctions they could have?
Sure. If you look at a company, and the book, by the way, is really aimed sort of at the business audience, right? It's not a legal book, so it's aimed at the business audience so that you're reading it to understand how these things work out. And so if you look at distress, most people think of distress as bankruptcy, right? I mean, it's a very simple equation. But in fact, a better definition of distress is sort of any time a company has an event or a contingency out in front of it, that if certain things don't happen, then the company will end up insolvent. Okay, and so you look at it, it's if you've got certain things that have to happen by a certain time, contingencies have to come true, or events have to happen for the company, and those events don't happen, then and you're looking at insolvency. That's the definition, basically, of when you need to look at restructuring, because restructuring is, as a global sort of theory, is the idea of coming up with contingency plans. And it's really hard to contingency plan when you're already past the events, when you've moved on past the events that you needed to take place for the company to survive. So, for example, to fill that out a little bit on restructuring, let's say that you've got a balloon note for a company, a bank loan, and it has a balloon on it at 3 years. You know that that's coming due by a certain time, and companies need to have plans as to how they're going to pay that off, right? And so if you get within 3 months of that and you realize you're not going to be able to pay it off, it's a little bit late to be trying to exercise strategies. That would be one. Another one is knowing that you've got to get product to market by a certain time and then recognizing that you're missing the deadlines. You're now starting on the early stage of missing the deadlines. You're going to push things back, for example, under technology licenses or something like that. And so it's looking at it at that stage. And distress, I should say, can go anywhere from relationships inside the company that cause it to be dysfunctional so it can't get its work done. And often you find relational distress within financially distressed companies, because financial distress sort of, it can have the effect of bringing out the worst in everyone. And then in addition, the other levels of distress are financial, especially financial, sometimes legal causes, but often it's financial and relational within a company.
Gotcha. Yeah, that's kind of a great background and a good place to start. So since our audience is mostly made up of entrepreneurs, I want to kind of pull out a couple of pieces of the book that I think really apply to our target audience. And kind of let's start with chapter 3, which is titled The Top 10 Reasons Companies That Should Make It Don't. And number 10, which is overexpansion. Can you tell us a little bit about that particular problem?
Sure. With the book, we go through the top 10 reasons, and I should note that it's not scientific, right? I mean, these are just reasons that we've seen companies fail over and over again. So overexpansion, number 10 on the list, is essentially the need to get there first, It's the need of a company to say, we're going to get the market on this first, and we're going to do whatever we have to expand to get there. Well, the problem is, as a company expands, you continually have to expand the amount of working capital and liquidity that the company has. So what's the definition of working capital? Working capital is the amount of money, monopoly is the best way to define it. Working capital is the amount of money it takes you to stay alive and go around the board until somebody lands on your properties and pays rent or you pass go and collect $200. Right? So, and that's working capital. Well, what happens is the longer things go on, the more working capital it takes. For example, as you continue to go around the board and the board builds up in monopoly, if you land on someone's property and all the properties now have hotels on them, your working capital need is a lot more to stay alive at that point in monopoly. And so it costs more money. So as a company expands, for example, if you're making product and it costs a certain amount of money to make product, then it takes 6 weeks from the time you first invest the product before you get paid for it. The amount of money it takes to run the company for that 6 weeks is the working capital need. And so what happens is if you're only making 100 units right now, when you go to making 20,000 units, it costs more money in raw materials, it costs more money in personnel and everything else, and the result is you have more working capital need. So what happens is companies will overexpand very quickly because they want to get the name out there first to own that segment of the market. And then the result is that by doing that, they aren't able to scale up their operations and to scale up their finances to keep up with it.
Gotcha. Can you give us an example? You know, you talked about a couple in the book. Can you give us one off
sure.
the top of your head?
A good example sort of on the working capital is to think about maybe a Bruno's, right? Bruno's is one that overexpanded and went out very, very quickly as a grocery store chain. Another example would to think about sort of with the top 10 list would be boo.com. And that actually comes back, that example dates all the way back to the .com bust. But boo.com was the first company that wanted to sell clothes on the internet. And they were going to be the leader at this, and they wanted to get to the market first. Well, their burn rate at boo.com was huge. They flew first class everywhere. They built the best best online system to sell clothes. The problem was most people's computers weren't good enough to be able to operate the software. On dial-up, you couldn't get these perfect clothing sales and perfect pictures of clothes downloaded fast enough. And so the company didn't make it. That's my usual example sort of in the overexpansion realm. There are hundreds. I bet the audience will have a bunch more to think about.
Yeah, so is there any guidance you can give some of our viewers out there to help them kind of avoid this or any questions or things to think about as they try to, you know, do that land grab and grow their business?
Yeah, I think it's important basically, and this will come up a few more times probably in our discussion, to have a cash management model that plans for growth. I have a friend who is a serial entrepreneur and now a professor of entrepreneurship who says all the time that one of the biggest reasons for failure is success. And so that companies succeed too quickly, they aren't prepared for it, and then as a result they fail. So it's watching out for that. It's also watching the burn rate, and that'll come up again here on the top 10 list.
Gotcha. And can you just break it down for us, kind of the components of maybe a cash management model?
Sure. What will often happen when you bring consultants in to look at a cash management model, especially when a company's hit distress, is they do what's called a 13-week cash flow. And the reason it's 13 weeks is obviously because they're it's not so obvious, and it wasn't obvious to me when I did my first income analysis at my first job and tried to figure out why I wasn't making any money. But 52 weeks, it's 13-week period, so you divide the year into quarters into 13-week periods. You can look at it on a quarterly basis. And so it's important to see a cash flow analysis that shows this is where we're going to be at cash zero or at cash negative, and then figure out how to flow through that. And I think the important point to make here is there are two types of insolvency in the world, there are multiple reasons businesses fail. But financially, there are two types of insolvency that happen to businesses. One is where they have a cash crunch. So the business may have a great underlying idea, it may have a lot of value on its books, but it doesn't have the liquidity to, and so it runs out of cash, and at that point has to fail. They can't find something to bridge through the gap. Another example, the other type of insolvency is balance sheet insolvency. That's where the assets on the balance sheet are actually worth less than the liabilities. Okay, the problem is there are a lot of companies that are balance sheet positive, with great ideas that have liquidity crunches, and so they have the cash crunch, and fail because of it. And so it's important to stay out front of that, and cash flow models with assumptions that you track very closely. Are key to that. And so companies need to be aware of that and to think about it and then to be checking against the model all the time. Internal controls on accounting are really important for that.
Gotcha, that makes a lot of sense. So it kind of summarized for the viewers, it seems like they need to do some research, think about their cash management model, and then document those assumptions, like you're saying, and actually track them closely so they don't run out of cash. Or if they know they're going to run out of cash, they can project it out and maybe line up some financing.
That's exactly right. But much better to line it up a week or two in advance, or let's say a month or two in advance, maybe even multiple months in advance than after the event has taken place when you're wondering if you're going to make payroll. But that's a great summary.
Yeah. Thank okay. You. Perfect. So number nine, we talk about bad capital structure. What the heck does that even mean?
Bad capital structure. It's having too much debt on a company. It's simply being over-levered, right? When a company is over-levered, what happens is so much of its cash flow has to go to debt that, and in fact, that it can't afford to cash flow. So much of its cash flow has to go to debt. It can't afford to cash flow. And what happens to it is if there's any, if it hits a bump in the road, every bump in the road basically becomes a moon crater, right? Because it's so overlevered that that they can't afford any hitches.
Gotcha.
And so if you look at a bad capital structure, basically you could sort of invert the pyramid. You'd rather have equity and then some debt in pieces, and really it's having it inverted the other way.
Gotcha. So you're saying you would normally want the debt on the top, the smallest chunk, and equity
right.
on the bottom. And
That's
in this
right.
case, it's the other way around. So can you give us any examples that maybe you've worked with or heard about that have failed because of their bad capital
sure.
structure?
Good example on that one would be sort of going back. Everybody's read Barbarians at the Gate, one of our favorites up there for business books. And Barbarians at the Gate was about RJR Nabisco, which went through a leveraged buyout. Well, leveraged buyout, what they did was they over-levered the company. And about 2 years later, it had significant financial problems. And so it's just the example of over-levering every time.
Gotcha. So when you say over-leveraging or over-levering, can you define that for our audience?
Sure. Over-levering is basically having more debt than the balance sheet of a company can really support. So to say it more simply, it's more debt than a company's cash flow can support.
Gotcha. So for instance, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, if they're making money selling products, but they owe more money in debt or interest payments than they're actually making, then they're upside down. They're not in a very good position.
That's right. You need to move to the place where your cash flow exceeds your inflow exceeds your outflow, right?
Yeah.
And so the problem is if you're over-levered, it means that there's more debt than there is value, or there's more debt service payments on debt than there is actual cash flow into the company.
Gotcha.
So available money to pay the debt.
Gotcha. So why would a company or how could a company find themselves in this position? It seems like with some accurate modeling or assumptions that they probably wouldn't, but is there anything we can learn or guide our viewers on how to avoid this?
Companies find themselves in this position so often. I'm amazed. There's a movie from the 80s called The River, and in that movie, it's about sort of the farm crisis in the 80s. When everything falls apart with the farms, they say to the bankers, "Well, you told us we were going to feed the world." The farmers say, "You said borrow this money, we'll feed the world, it'll be great." And now you're taking all the money back. What happens a lot of times is there's an overexuberance in the market, and capital may be too accessible. For example, it might be too cheap. So in the mid-2000s, I think there's a consensus now that in the mid-2000s, lending money came too cheaply. Banks were willing to loan without taking account of the risk. The result is that that companies borrow more than they can really afford to borrow. I mean, actually, it happens in the housing market all the time too, right? And this, and so you can look at it, moving for just for a moment from the business world, sort of where I spend all my time working, to the residential world that we read about all the time in the papers. The people borrowed much more than they could ever pay back, thinking, "Hey, this won't be a problem. I can do it," because they were offered more money. And so it's not putting blame on any sort of side of that. I think the point is, a lot of times there's excess liquidity. There's available to companies, and they simply draw it down and then don't have the cash to pay it back. There's also the potential that value shift, right? If underlying value in the company shifts, then a company can end up over-levered. So based on its initial projections and its initial business plan, company may have been in excellent shape to proceed, but what happens is, as its projections aren't met, it sells less than it's supposed to, and then it ends up with far more debt than it can carry.
Yeah, that's a good summary. That makes a lot of sense. So it seems like that overexuberance that can get you in trouble, but it also seems like you're saying a company that had some accurate projections but had a bump in the road that maybe delayed something or slowed something down or killed a market could also cause this. They might have been properly leveraged at the moment, but then something happened. So it seems like what you're saying is, you know, partly you could possibly avoid the situation, but possibly you couldn't, depending on how your business is structured and what ends up happening to it. But also seems like, again, going back to the pyramid, if liquidity is available, then you might want to look to take it from the equity players in this case, as opposed to the debt, because it seems like they're not going to be calling. It could cause different problems in the future if you take too much investment on, but it seems like it would be a possible solution. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that's right. Equity is always more expensive than debt when a company is healthy. And so because it dilutes the company debt and the ownership of the company. So getting debt is easier, but having those two out of balance causes a lot of problems for companies. And so it's key to make sure that those come together. And I want to make sure that one of the themes comes out here too. This is in the book, but I think it's very important for the discussion about the reasons companies fail and how to fix companies. We'll talk about sort of what management issues can come up and everything else, but I think it's important to understand that companies fail all the time without necessarily anyone being at fault. It can be a function of outside factors. I heard a quote a few years ago that many, many of the Silicon Valley successful company leaders and successful executive teams have been through several bankruptcies on failed ventures prior to the one that they hit out of the park. Yeah. And so it's something that sort of happens to people who have to take big risks to make big reward. And it's a reality sometimes. It's not always somebody's fault.
Yeah, that's good. That's a good point to drive home. So let's go on to number eight, which is fail to control controllable costs. Can you explain this for us?
Yeah, controllable costs are things like burn rates. And when we talk about burn rate, let's say controllable costs would be in the Boo.com example, controlling the costs of the spend on the technology. Flying coach, going to less nice hotels. I mean, that's the burn on the front end. And so what happens a lot of times is companies look at it and they say, you know, this is such a win. This strategy is going to go global and we'll hit it, that they spend much more than they have at the time. Strategy isn't as successful as they expect. And the result is that the company takes the hit for it. And so it's looking at it from a cash flow perspective and saying, what can we control? Let's try to be good stewards of the resources that we have to make sure from a cash flow perspective that they'll last all the way to the end. Let's not assume that more money will always be available.
Gotcha. That makes a lot of sense. Let's hop back and forth between 7 and 8. 7 says plan or failure to plan to control uncontrollable costs.
Sure. Yeah, and when we talk about uncontrollable costs, basically we're talking about things like insurance, like energy costs, things that really you may not be able to project. Now, you can hedge against these things. For large industries, they do hedge against them. But you can't necessarily know where these prices are going to come out for certain materials over time. So controlling controllable costs, when we go to controllable costs, that's things like controlling your staff levels, right? I mean, a company may say, we want to have complete creative control. And so with complete creative control, that means we have to have the full staff to produce everything. We can't outsource anything. That's a huge cost. So that's a controllable cost, right? It's being made by as part of a strategic judgment. If it's strategic, okay. But the problem is a lot of times it's not, there's not a deliberate decision made about it. The now, uncontrollable costs, instead of being things like, hey, we've made the decision we have to have we made the decision that we have to have complete creative control. Instead, it's things like the fuel prices, the insurance prices that go up that are unexpected. And, you know, whatever goes up must come down. The problem is it may not come down for a while yet. And so I think John Maynard Keynes said, everybody would talk about in the long run of economics. And his quote was, in the long run, we are all dead.
Yeah, that's a good quote. So for the uncontrollable costs, what kind of guidance can you provide us, or what kind of advice can you provide our viewers in terms of, it is something that it'd be hard to factor in to say, insurance costs are going to go up exactly 20%, or fuel costs are probably going to rise over time, but they do dip and then rise and dip and rise. So what kind of advice or guidance can you give our viewers?
I think, and this isn't practical in all circumstances, because for entrepreneurs and venture people, you have to take chances on this. Companies are often going to be thinly capitalized, and you're going to have to take chances. But I think the bottom line is to try to leave some margin in the business. If a business is always getting by the skin of its teeth each week, it's going to be really hard to take this. And so, again, it's planning for that bump in the road so that it doesn't become the moon crater.
Gotcha. That makes a lot of sense. So it seems like with the margin, that means just because you have some money in the bank doesn't mean you should spend it. Keep it in the bank.
That's a very apt analogy.
And then it seems like that ties into the over-exuberance, because if you think everything's going right and going your way, why wouldn't you just pay for some more advertising or pay for another salary?
I think that's right.
So it seems
just because you can does not mean you should.
Gotcha. Is there any rule of thumb or thoughts out there about how much to keep in the bank or anything like along those lines?
Depends on business size, really, and it's sort of a financial modeling issue, and so it'd be hard to give a guideline on it. It also depends on sort of how what the volatility of the business is. For example, if you're talking about a business that has a pretty steady market, then it would be fairly easy probably to predict that the margin would go 20% up or down in a year. Maybe it's 5% up or down in a year. But with a company that's, for example, if you were looking at energy trading like Enron, the volatility could be 100% or more in a year, 1,000% or more in a year. And so from that perspective, it's hard to figure out how much to bank you. It's an industry and company specific issue.
Gotcha. So it still seems like something our viewers should be wary or cognizant of, and then dig into their specific industry or sector and find other people doing similar things that they look up to that maybe can provide them with some guidance along the lines.
I think that's a great point. Good mentoring along these lines, and then good good guideposts from other companies and competitors. Great point.
Yeah, so we're going to skip a couple of these for the sake of time. Sure. And to tease the book out a little bit. Not give it away. But let's skip number six. Let's go to number five, which is poor internal controls and integration. Can you share with us or unpack that a little bit?
Sure. As you look at internal controls and integration, this deals with sort of two. Integration is when you're combining two companies or multiple technologies. And often there are things that get missed in that process. And so there's underlap instead of overlap. And so things get missed in the process. There's a lot of lost institutional knowledge, and there are a lot of inefficiencies. when you talk about internal controls, that internal controls would actually encompass integration of companies, because internal controls are your financial controls. Internal controls would be your sort of accounting and then operational controls in the company. So, for example, in your accounting department, you've got regular monthly accounting. Maybe you have weekly forecasting and accounting, but probably let's assume it's regular monthly financial reports that you're getting, that you're checking against budget to see how you're doing, things like that. It's having oversight. It's making sure you don't have one person who is in charge of writing all the checks, because you don't necessarily know that you are. You don't have some type of fraud going on. It's creating a system of compliance and controls so that the company can determine its position all the time, check itself against budget, protect against fraud, and really be able to steer the course and know how it's doing.
Gotcha. So it seems like these could be either two issues or one issue together. And I guess you're talking about integration, meaning one company merging with another, swallowing another company up, and kind of the fold in together and how that process looks.
That's right. And what you have in an integration problem is really just a type of internal control issue. Because what happens a lot of times with integration is that the companies fail to look, let's say you merge in another company and it becomes a division. If you fail to realize how they're accounting for certain things or to get their information into your accounting system, then you might be having to run two or three different accounting systems to keep up with things, which isn't efficient. You can't tell how you're doing. You're months after the fact when you can determine how your financial performance actually was. You might have lost a lot of money before you figure out how you did. And so so it's getting everything integrated quickly, and that's a form. Integration itself is actually falls into internal controls. Having good internal controls is so important. And for an example of that, I mean, you could use any, I'll give you two, just sort of quickly thinking about it. One, obviously, let's go back to Enron. Talk about poor internal controls. They were unable to track a lot of things that were going on there. The second example would be a small town camera shop that I knew about probably 10 to 15 years ago, where the owner couldn't figure out why he was losing money all the time. And so he had his accountants come in and take a look at his books, and they ran a metric on the books that actually showed sort of cost of goods and profit on goods sold. And when they ran the metric, it showed he was losing money on every unit. Couldn't figure that out, but he knew he was making money on every unit. So they said, well, that means somebody's walking out the back door every night with a bunch of cameras. So the next night, what he did was he went and parked out back with his accountant and watched. And when the guy that he had minding the store closed up at 9 o'clock that night, closed the camera store, he walked out the back door with two boxes of cameras. And hence where all the inventory was going and how the loss showed up. So poor internal controls had caused the problem. Bringing in a consultant to look at it and review it, they found it pretty quickly. We're able to fix it and save the company.
Gotcha. So it seems like something we need to be proactive about, but also seems like it's more than just, you know, when you merge two companies, the overlap of talent. You're saying it's the overlap of the way the financial systems are run, or the operation systems, where
the operation controls as well.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. And how, you know, one party might not know how exactly the other party's structured, so they're running without some crucial information they should have. So it seems like being proactive and taking the steps early on to make sure you integrate properly is going to save you some heartache in the long run.
Yeah, it could be without information. It could be without supervision, right? All those things which can provide significant problems. And at the end of the day, because we're human, there are always human error. There are always amounts of human error in this. The key is that what internal controls do is they handicap the amount of human error that you have, and then you're able to minimize it, right? So that you can figure out how much. You can only control it within so much, but maybe you get your maybe you get it down to a 2% margin of error, something like that, instead of a 20% margin of error, which sinks the business.
Gotcha. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Number four is poorly designed business models. So can you give us an example of a company that went under because of this, or maybe had some trouble because of it?
Yeah, poorly designed business model would be, I think, two. One would be, let's say, Pets.com. Great idea. I wish I had the puppet. I wish I'd bought it on eBay when it went on sale. Just an icon of sort of that era. The problem was with Pets.com that ultimately it's very inefficient, no matter what you sell your dog food at, to be able to ship it. Because transportation costs, at the end of the day, make it very, very difficult. Unless you have people who've decided, I'm not going to go to the pet store or the grocery store, and I'm going to have everything shipped to me and live off of the internet, it becomes difficult to be profitable in high dollar items that pets use because pet food's heavy, right? It becomes a problem. Another one would be sort of service merchandise. And this is a company that that died in the late 90s, early 2000s, and it had been for many years a great catalog company that and it sold jewelry and sort of electronics and was a great company that just failed to adapt to sort of the internet age and then the category killers that came along, such, you know, the companies that came along and would just sell electronics. Well, they could do it more cheaply than service merchandise could sell everything in general.
Gotcha. That makes a lot of sense. So are there any particular elements of the business model that we should have our viewers look at when they're launching their business or evaluating it currently?
I think that this one's the one that probably comes most intuitively to entrepreneurs. It's looking at the business model and saying, you know, is this a product that's going to fly? And am I going to be able to do it? Am I going to be able to produce it in a way that's efficient enough to make it through to the end and to make it successful? So this is much more intuitive, but very, very often there are examples of it out there in the market. And some of that's just a function of risk.
Gotcha. Makes a lot of sense. Let's dig into number one, which is management in denial. What does that mean? What are you saying about our viewers out there?
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes I present this to an entrepreneurship class, and I have a PowerPoint for it. And the PowerPoint slide for this for management in denial is actually a photo of a bunch of workers in hazmat suits who are cleaning up a hazmat spill. And then you've got a guy standing right next to him in a tropical shirt and shorts and sandals. He's got his hands in his pocket. He's smiling at the camera and waving. And everybody else around him is in hazmat suits. Well, it's sort of not recognizing all of the problems that are coming true as a business is struggling. And so to dig in on this one a little more, management and denial is a problem that we see so commonly with distressed companies. And some of it is a result of a misunderstanding of financial distress. You know, the dichotomy between healthy and bankrupt. Well, we're not bankrupt. Okay, so let's keep doing what we've done. Let's keep trying to be a healthy company, and we'll pull out of this. The other part of it it's not just the failure to recognize it that leads to the denial, but it's also sort of the survival instinct and the I've got to hold on to this, and I can't handle the potential if this doesn't work. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to hold on to the idea that something's going to come through in the end, and I'm just going to keep waiting for that. And it ends up, unfortunately, being sort of the pie in the sky hope that isn't fulfilled. And at that point, by the time management recognizes that its hopes are not going to be fulfilled by unrealistic expectations, it's too late to save the company. And so if you think about it, what happens is, I want to be clear on this too as we talk about management. Management denial is a problem because of the lack of awareness, and then also because of just the inability psychologically to deal with distress. Both of those things are very hard. There are a lot of failures that happen that are not the fault of management, that are the fault of a lot of other factors and everything else. And remember, many successful entrepreneurs, especially those at the top, have been through unsuccessful companies and learned from that. So, but the key to saving a company that's savable is recognizing it early and intervening so that you don't deny the problems. Because denial doesn't make the problem go away. And the key to, it's the same key for maximizing the value and minimizing the losses in an unsavable company. So if you have a savable company, intervening early will actually create the highest likelihood that you can save it. If you have an unsavable company, intervening early will result in the highest return for the creditors and potentially some left over for equity.
Gotcha. That makes a lot of sense. So it seems like, you know, you talk about recognizing the issues early and acting swiftly and trying to avoid the denial that might set in. Is there anything, any particular metrics or anything we can look at? Obviously, we talked about 10 reasons why businesses fail, but what are the first things that go? Is it profit margin? Is it market share? What are the things that, what are some like early warning signs that we can think about?
Yeah, it can be all of those, right? I mean, it could be people that, it could be a loss of people within the company also, you know, because people are, what is it, good to great? It's not people that are your greatest asset, it's the right people. You know, and losing the right people at the company could be a huge problem. Seeing market share erode. So reasons why companies fail, we've outlined a lot of them. As far as metrics and warning signs to look at, I'll tell you that the first metric is realizing that you're having to stretch your vendors. When you're having to begin to stretch your suppliers, that's usually a warning sign that that you're falling into distress, because the easiest way to get additional working capital is simply not to pay your vendor expenses for a little while, your suppliers. You're certainly going to pay payroll, right? I mean, that's something, you can't miss payroll for all your employees or you won't have a business the next day. And so, but it's stretching the suppliers is a warning sign. Often, I won't say that failing to take a salary by entrepreneurs is a warning sign, because lots of startup businesses have to do that. But it's having modeled it potentially where you were taking salaries and then you get to the point where you can't anymore. Well, that's the point where you need to say, all right, what are we modeling for? How are we going to do this? Because are we realistic about the presumptions at the end? The other one is, sort of having to live hand to mouth when it comes to making payments on loans, when you're really close on being able to make loan payments. And I think one of the real keys that you can look at and is looking at the covenants that you often have in bank loans, whether or not those bank loans, whether or not the company actually has bank loans, and whether or not it actually has those covenants in it. Looking at standard bank covenants is a great way to check a company's metric to see how it's doing. And so things like fixed charge coverage ratio. So that's its ability to cash flow enough money to pay its debt, you know, debt to equity coverage ratios, things like that. And then, and finally, sort of checking budgets against, checking budget performance against actual performance and being on top of that. And then sort of, so again, it comes back to internal controls, giving you the ability to turn all the data that's out there into information so that a company can then recognize its current position, which might be to recognize, hey, we're doing great, might be to recognize, hey, we're not. But you'd rather know that sooner rather than later.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Kind of to summarize, it seems like what you said is one of the early warning signs is stretching vendors, which makes a lot of sense, but so should stick in our viewers' minds as something that's kind of a warning sign. If that even has to be put on the table as an option, not taking a salary, then getting to the point where you're able to, but then realizing you have to go back and not take it. That's another warning sign. And then, like you're saying, loan payments. And then it seems like one other thing you're talking about is kind of individual metrics that are kind of unique for each business and something that kind of goes along with your own budget and your own priorities as a business.
That's right. Gotcha. I think, I'd say another one is being aware of sort of the growth of the business. So I'm going to go back to the one of the biggest causes of failure is often success. So it's watching the growth of the business and the need for additional working capital, the need to staff it out, and being willing to often realize that a lot of issues at companies end up being psychological, right? I mean, it ends up being emotional. You're emotionally tied into something, and so it's emotionally being willing to let go of the reins as something grows and bring in the people that you need to handle all the functions. Suddenly realizing that you're working 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, may be a sign of success, but it's only short-term success for the company because it's not sustainable for the individual, right? You've got to expand it out into the other people that need to be behind it. You can look at it in terms of all those pieces and then the metrics that can be specific to it. And I want to make one example going back a few years. If you look back in the mid-2000s, we had what we call covenant-lite loans. And loans in that period, the Economist actually called them diet covenants, was its favorite way to put it. But the but covenant-lite loans, basically, the only way to default a covenant-lite loan was to not make a payment, right? I mean, it was just, that's the ultimate covenant-lite. Some other loans had very minimal covenants, and so you could miss a covenant. So, and when I talk about covenants, I'm talking about things like debt to equity ratio, talking about the fixed charge coverage ratio, the sort of ratios of income to debt and, that are measured different ways throughout the company, and then budget projections and those things, and those things are in bank loans for real reasons, so that the bank can recognize the early warning signs of distress and then intervene in the process, right? So the bank can protect its own loan to this company. Well, covenant-lite loans didn't give the banks the ability to do that, and the companies weren't incentivized to do it a lot of times either. And so it's important for companies to learn. I'd tell a company that one of the best things it can do is sort of learn from the banking practice of what covenants banks like to do in conservative years of banking. When banks are being conservative in making those loans, what covenants do they want? What do they want to see? Don't put them in your loans if you can avoid it. Negotiate them out of your loan documents, but track them yourself. They're very, very important to be tracked internally at the company, because those signs, if your bank wanted those early warning signs about its loan, wouldn't you like to have those early warning signs about your own investment in the company and potentially your life's work that you're building up to its apex?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So look inside those internal loan documents, read the fine print, do some research and see it. And if you can negotiate it out, like you're saying, do it, because it'll be helpful for you as a business, but also know that they have those in there for a reason. They're a key financial metric to kind of pay attention to. So it seems like so far in this interview, we've talked about the 10 reasons or some of the 10 reasons why businesses that fail or that shouldn't fail. And you also talked about just now the warning signs. Let's briefly review kind of the 6 options that you lay out of what people that are going through, you know, issues in their business can do to turn it around or to get out, and then kind of leave it up to our viewers to do some more research if they find themselves in this position. So let's start with number one, which is resurrection. Can you give us a brief overview of that?
Yeah, as you look at distress, the one of the issues is that, remember, it's healthy and it's bankrupt. There are two sides to it. So the solutions are, well, let's go sell more, or, oh, gosh, that didn't work out. We cut expenses. We tried to sell more. It didn't work. So now we go bankrupt. There are a million options in between. And that's because of the way that these six exit strategies for financial distress fit together. Okay, and so the way to think about it, resurrection is the first one. Basically, resurrection is the ability, when you recognize that your business is struggling, to go in and try to find ways to increase revenue and to cut costs. So you improve your top line, you improve your midline, and by doing that, you improve the bottom line of your business. And so again, going back to financial controls, I think it's important to have a strong financial team around the company, one way or another. That's what's key. So you look at resurrection, it's being able to fix the company's balance sheet by fixing the business itself, right? Increasing sales, cutting expenses without having to do something else, like stretching vendors or anything else.
Gotcha, that makes a lot of sense. Number two is refinancing.
Yeah, refinancing, that's taking your existing package of debt. Let's say you have a balloon note coming due soon, or you have debt that's very, very expensive, something like that, and then moving from that into a refinancing structure. And I would say that resurrection and refinancing are the two most popular restructuring strategies. The issue is a lot of people view these as sort of healthy company strategies. Hey, we're just refinancing our debt or whatever. But the problem is, remember, a restructuring is anytime you've got a company that has events or contingencies in the future that if they don't come true and there's a reasonable certainty they're not going to come true, then they're in a restructuring. And so the refinancing is actually an option to get the company back from potential bad outcomes to very good outcomes.
Gotcha. And is refinancing actually taking a loan and saying, instead of paying it over the first 5 years, we're actually going to stretch it out and pay it over 10, making our monthly payments in half to simplify. Is that how refinancing works?
I think I'd take refinancing and put it in the category more of saying, all right, we have an existing bank loan and we've got a whole bunch of existing obligations to vendors and we're having trouble paying all that and we can't make the bank payments on time, we can't pay our vendors on time, but we got another lender out here who will loan us enough money for all of those expenses, right? So we can pay off our other bank, we can pay off our vendors and catch them up. And so to put numbers on it, say there's a $5 million existing bank loan and there are $2 million out to vendors that are late. And the $5 million bank loan has a balloon that comes due in a year and the interest rate's too high and companies can't afford the payments. Well, if you can get another company to loan you $7 or $8 million, right, then suddenly if you've got seven, you've paid off your prior bank, you've paid off your vendors and caught it up and you've got $7 million. If you've got eight, you got another $1 million of working capital potentially. And you use and you get the refinancing hopefully at a lower rate or over a longer period of time, so you've stretched it out so you can make those payments at a reasonable level. You don't have a balloon coming due that's just around the corner. Balloon notes, when the payments due just around the corner, we refer to those as bullets for a reason.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And number three is re-equitizing.
Re-equitizing essentially is bringing new equity funds into the company. So as we think about it, you've got, instead of bringing debt onto the balance sheet, what you're doing is you're bringing new equity into the company. Now, depending on what sort of distress level the company is at, the re-equitizing may be very expensive. They may want a high percentage of the equity because they're coming in, equity comes in below debt, right? So if the company fails, the new equity is going to lose all of its money too. But bringing new equity in gives the company the ability to have more working capital to pay down some existing debt. So it's usually a fairly effective strategy. And an example would be going to a private equity fund and having a buyout, right? Which again is thought of as a healthy company strategy. But if the company is in a situation where it has certain contingencies or events that have to happen, and there's a reasonable likelihood they're not going to happen, this is now a restructuring strategy. And the company needs to be looking at it globally to say, if my preferred strategy is to go to a refinancing, but if my bank doesn't refinance me, what am I going to do? Right? Have I got a backup? And that's to be negotiating with a private equity fund for a buyout or for a new investment or to find some angel investors or whatever that is to put new equity money in.
Gotcha. And I think one of the key things that you hit on was the fact that they're coming in at a risky point. They're going to actually want more of your company. So like you talked about earlier, these types of investors, the better off your company's doing, the less they'll take. So if you're in this position, they're coming in not necessarily as a shark. They want to see you succeed because they want their money back, but they're coming in and smelling a little bit of blood out of there and want to get the best deal for themselves.
Yeah, there are ways to bring it in maybe as preferred equity where they'll come in for a little while and then go back out. There would be ways to take the, in a refinancing structure, sometimes you can bring it in as sub-debt. So you kind of come in between equity and senior debt. There are different levels you can bring it in. So maybe they aren't taking the real long-term ownership of the company. But you can bet that if there's a preferred equity there, and the company's having some distress or is in restructuring, there's a likelihood that if the events don't go right, that preferred equity is going to come in and it's going to have the right to come in and take over the ownership of the company.
Ah, gotcha. So let's go on to number four, which is re-amortizing.
Yeah, re-amortizing debt is basically taking your existing debt and a true re-amortization would just be stretching it out over a longer period of time. But what often happens, I use this category to explain both. It can be lowering the interest rate, it can be reducing the principal amount, and it can be stretching out over a longer period. Let's talk about, though, what that looks like. It's different from a refinancing, right? A refinancing may result in a lower interest rate and a longer period that it's worked out over, but that's from a new loan that comes in, from a new financing source usually. In this case, with reamortization, what we're talking about is there are two ways to do reamortizations. One is to get all of your creditors together to agree that they'll take this. So your lender agrees, hey, we'll take payment over a longer period of time, we'll lower the interest rate, we'll lower some of the principal, or here's how we'll work this out. Your vendors say, okay, we'll let you stretch us a little further, you can pay us there. that's a voluntary workout, which is a reamortization. The other form of reamortization is a forced workout, which is a Chapter 11 bankruptcy, where you take the company, you put it in a Chapter 11 bankruptcy, and you tell the creditors, hey, we want your help, and we want you to come along with us and do it this way, and we're going to reorganize the company and be successful. But if you don't want to come along with us, we're going to stretch you out anyway. We're going to reduce your principal. We're going to reduce your interest rate and stretch you. And we're going to get relief from our obligations that way. So reamortization is two things. One is a voluntary workout with your creditors. The other is a Chapter 11.
Gotcha. All right. And number five is going concern sale.
Yeah, the going concern sale. So you take the company and you basically look at it and you sell it. Know that that companies that are healthy usually sell at a multiple of cash flow, right? Companies in distress frequently sell at a discount to asset value. So the key here again is to try to intervene early so that you, if you're going to do a going concern sale, you do it not when the distress is deep, right? You don't want to be in deep distress when you make the sale because you're going to sell at a discount to asset value and everybody's going to lose. Although you will preserve as much as you could. Instead, you want to sell it, you want to try and do it when you still have some positive cash flow and you can still get some level of multiple.
Gotcha. So it seems, again, coming back to being out in front of things and knowing what's going on, or at least trying to catch up. And this might be one of the ways to turn it around or get out if you're able to do that.
That's right.
And then the last one is liquidation.
Yeah, if you look at liquidation, that's simply the last ditch effort. That's when everything else has failed, and so what happens is the company liquidates and the assets are sold off piecemeal. So looking back over the six, you've got resurrection, which is the best, and actually all of these are except for liquidation are geared toward resurrecting the company somehow, right? Whether it's under new ownership or not, but there's resurrection without having to use another method. There's refinancing, there's re-equitization, there's re-amortization, there's a going concern sale, and there's a liquidation. And the six of those and the combinations of them comprise every exit strategy that exists. And so companies have to look at it globally across those six to say, this is how, we're restructuring, we're not bankrupt yet, let's not file Chapter 11, let's see if we can't refinance or re-equitize or sell some part of it as a going concern.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. So how can people find you online, or where can they connect with you and find your book?
Sure, Distress to Success is the book, and it is the website is www.distresstosuccessbook.com, and that's all spelled out, Distress to Success book. .com. The book is also available on Amazon, at Barnes & Noble, in bookstores. My email address is bguy, at fbtlaw.com. That's FBT for Frost Brown Todd, fbtlaw.com. And my phone number is 615-251-5557, 615-251-5557. And I thought, case of interest to your viewers, I'll just sort of put this out there. If the first five emails that I get from viewers that have watched this, I'm happy to send out free copies of the book.
Nice.
And that's not to people who necessarily, it doesn't mean you have to need restructuring help or anything else. That means you just happened to watch this video and you sent me the email and said, hey, I'd like a copy of the book. First five, we'll get free copies.
Perfect. I appreciate it. To all our viewers out there, you can find this and additional episodes of the Startup Slingshot, as well as other educational series on the startupslingshot.com. Bobby, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much.